Are we hot? All right. After the introduction of that rocket that you saw this morning, I think maybe all introductions are superfluous, but obviously they're not. Some things need to be said. And the first speaker in Houston this afternoon will be Dr. Robert Siemens, the Deputy Administrator of NASA. Dr. Siemens?
Well, what we've all seen and heard today has been the result of a hard-driving, disciplined effort that's been carried out for an extended period of time. The engine development was initiated in 59 and 60 as the engine that powered the first stage of the Saturn V, the F1 engine, was started first, and the J2 engine was started a short time later, both in President Eisenhower's administration. Then in 1961, after a careful review of the of this country's position in space, including a careful look at the Soviet program, President Kennedy, on recommendation from then Vice President Johnson, recommended a major acceleration in our space activity. This led rather immediately to approval by the Congress and the initiation of programs to develop a major new launch vehicle capability and to initiate development of an advanced manned spacecraft that would have the capability to maneuver, rendezvous, dock, and carry out missions out to and including landing on the moon and return. At the press conference yesterday, we stated that today we'd be flight testing the Saturn V, that is this new launch vehicle, for the first time. We said that we'd be flight testing the Apollo reentry at lunar return speeds for the first time. We said that we would be live testing our launch and operational facilities for the first time. And it would be testing a development and operational team in its first major mission for the first time. These goals, as you know, have all been accomplished. Today, we placed in near-Earth orbit over 280,000 pounds. To give this some perspective, this is three times the weight of the six manned Mercury capsules and the nine Gemini capsules that have been flown by our astronauts. In response to questions yesterday, we said that we would not be completely satisfied with Apollo 4, that is today's mission, unless we went through the planned mission all the way to spacecraft recovery. I say the mission is successful because the Bennington is now alongside the capsule, and we can be sure that it will be aboard in 30 or 40 minutes. We know that we have obtained a great deal of important data. Just the conduct of the mission itself gives us very valuable information. We have the spacecraft to inspect. We have all of our telemetered information and photographic data obtained on the ground. We've recovered two cassettes that were taking movies from the S2 stage so that we will have a great deal of information to analyze and to evaluate. And we know that this is extremely important for the upcoming succession of flights that will lead to and certainly include the lunar landing. But I believe that more important even than this is the clear indication that our team of government, industry, and university people was not found wanting, and that we do have the capacity in this country to be preeminent, not only in space, but in all human endeavor involving science and technology. The power of the Saturn V is exceeded many-fold by our power in this country to accomplish the near impossible for the good of all mankind. Thank you.
Dr. Miller?
I'd like to say just a few words, of my pleasure, my pride, and my happiness for the results of the work of the 300,000 people who at one time or another have contributed to the Apollo program and to the success that we have enjoyed today. A friend of mine, Bob Holtz, whom many of you know, has accused me of failing in times past to convey any idea of the magnitude of the task that was exemplified by the flight that we pulled off today. Bob's analogy to the Apollo program is one that says it's the combination of three of the greatest projects that man has ever undertaken in the past. A combination of the building of the pyramids, the creation of our nuclear weapon systems, and the development of the supersonic transport, all rolled into one. Now that may be a bit of a superlative, but to give you some idea of the magnitude of the of just one aspect of today's flight. You know, there were over 125 computers which were programmed to talk to one another in order to carry out the communications that were used to identify and understand what was happening to the launch vehicle and the spacecraft as it traveled around the world. And that represents one of the largest programming jobs ever undertaken in this nation. I was groping for some measure of the magnitude of the particular flight today, and I may be getting carried away, but in a very real sense, the complexity of this flight is equivalent to taking the first nuclear submarine, instrumenting it so that it could be driven out by itself across the ocean to a target point and then returned, checking it out on the ways at the factory, and then launching it, and letting it go forth and return, all without human intervention, or at least without anything other than sending commands to it. I do think that this was a tremendous achievement, and I again say I'm proud of all of the people that have been involved in the program. Thank you.
Well, I don't believe all the participants have gathered yet at the Cape. There's a gentleman down there who himself has had a lot to do with the development of this rocket and who heads a very able team that had everything to do with the building of the launch vehicle. I'm sure everybody would like to hear from you, Dr. Von Braun. This is called Cueing in the Blind. We'd like to wait. All right, if we can come back to Houston. I'm sorry, Bill Schneider?
I can't add much to what was said there. As a matter of fact, I don't think I can add anything. I would like to say one thing that I've been wanting to say for all the past 5 years. In all sincerity, I'd like to thank the American people for their faith in our space program, which has given me the opportunity to work with people I've been working with. Thank you.
General in Houston?
Well, I'd first like to congratulate the NASA government team for this very significant, very tremendous success today. I can say that, and speak for the DOD, that we certainly are happy to be a part of it. In respect to today's mission, we were operating with a new team in a lot of respects. I'd like to mention Admiral Christopher's name, who is the commander of the task group in the Atlantic, Admiral Lynch's name, who is the commander of the task group in the Pacific, and it was very gratifying to work with them and see their status of preparations and responsiveness to the possible problems, which fortunately we didn't have to carry out. But there were a few significant things in today's mission which portend things for the future. Today in the network, we had the first Apollo ship, for the first time, the Vanguard. There will be five of these eventually. It performed its job in very worthwhile fashion, and we're quite proud of that. We also had the five Apollo aircraft up, five of the eight that we will have eventually, and in all respects, they performed their job. On launch, one of our jobs was to attempt to photograph, observe, and recover the S-1C stage. We did observe it. We did photograph it, I understand. But of course, it broke up, and we recovered some of the debris. Another job was to recover the photo cassettes, which we did recover intact. And as far as I know, they are back at the Cape right now. The rest of the mission was complicated in regards to the recovery, in that we had a large number of contingency abort plans that we were ready to carry out, which gave us some very significant training and preparation for the future. The only thing significant we had to worry about particularly was the weather in the primary recovery area and west 900 miles where the destroyer, the Carpenter, was. In this case, we had a front along the path, which we looked at very closely last night and this morning, and decided to continue the aiming point after discussions with Mr. Kraft and Mr. Snyder here. Fortunately, why came right down within 5.9 miles of the carrier. That's the figure I heard, and it was a good decision, I believe. So again, it was a very significant mission, very well done. We're happy to be part of it, and we look forward to greater things in the future.
Thank you, General. Our next speaker is Mr. Christopher Columbus Kraft, with a K, our Director of Flight Operations.
Thank you, Paul. I'm very pleased to say that I'm very proud of the team that we had in the control center today, run by Mr. Lunny. Very proud of those boys. I think they did a wonderful job. The people at the Goddard Space Flight Center are not represented here, but I think we ought to point out that today was a big day for them in bringing up the new Apollo network. It was quite a job to get that system ready for this flight. I think they did a tremendous job and certainly ought to be congratulated. I think the whole Apollo team and the Apollo hardware matured today, and I'm proud to see our boys a part of it. Mr. Lunny.
Well, Chris has mentioned all the elements of the team that we work with, and I also was delighted with the way that the team acted and conducted themselves throughout the test today and the planning and the pre-launch operations that we've been engaged in for the last several months. Speaking for, I'm sure, all the members of the team in the control center and all the people around the world, I think all we have to say, it was a great thrill to be a part of this operation, and it's wonderful to see the mission itself be so successful.
And speaking for as an old man of 30 years old, that's quite a statement, Mr. Lunny. I understand Dr. Von Braun may want to reserve his comments till the other center directors are there later. Have they arrived yet? Well, if not, then we'll proceed with questions in Houston, if there are any.
I was referring, in a sense, to morale in my opening remarks. The team was not found wanting today, and I'm sure that having carried out such a successful mission, that this will give the team confidence for future missions, and it will give those who must provide the resources, the country at large, Congress, I'm certain, confidence that they are providing resources for a team that is going to make maximum use of the facilities and of the people involved to achieve maximum benefit, not only for the lunar landing, and important as that is, but for a variety of short and long-term benefits.
How close did you come in your trajectories and burns to your nominals? Do you have any figures you can use at all?
I didn't bring all the papers over, but as far as we could tell, everything was just about on the money. We inserted into an orbit which was probably within 2 miles of what we were shooting for. The second burn was the second Saturn IV, S4B burn, was very, very close to what we aimed for. We followed that up with a 16-second burn with the service propulsion system. The planned burn was 15 seconds, as you know. We were very, very close to our desired cutoff conditions. The second service propulsion burn, the last one of the day, I think the accuracy of it can be attested by the landing point, which was about 18,000 yards from the carrier. So we couldn't have been happier with the accuracy of the systems and the way the vehicles performed during the major maneuvers.
Are there questions at the Cape?
Party arriving. We hope that the whole group will be here shortly. Right here in the front row.
Somebody's volume is down. Let's try it again.
Would you repeat the question, sir?
Was the re-entry sequence and the subsequent landing nominal in all respects?
I think the question is about the re-entry sequence. Is that right?
Cape, we're not hearing you at all. Give me that. Yeah, Jack, give me the question. Okay. The question is, was the reentry sequence normal?
In a word, yes. We played the tapes back from Guam, the station at Guam, and we were able to verify the last function that we were not able to verify in real time, that is, the separation was normal. From there on in, we had contact with the Araya aircraft, that is, the Araya aircraft had contact with the spacecraft at about the time we expected them to, as we went through the two blackouts, and the reports were about on time, near as we could tell. And then the final proof of the pudding, of course, was the visual contact with the spacecraft on chutes off the bridge of the Bennington.
But you're satisfied that somebody did see the events going into blackout and coming out?
We saw the events through separation. The next event that we really have a very good hack on is the landing time, which seemed to me to be within about 15 seconds of what we predicted before we went into the sequence. So I can only judge at this time that it was as normal as we could get.
Okay, did you copy that, Jay?
Right.
Okay.
Art Snyder, Chicago Daily News, for Mr. Lunny. Did the black boxes do the job that a man could have done in this mission, or was there any point at which you would have liked to have seen a man in the loop?
Well, I guess I would have liked to have seen a man in the loop the whole way, and the sooner we can move into that, the happier we'll be in the program, and the more safely and more successfully, I think, we'll be able to operate the missions. However, as the equipment was designed for the flight, as near as we could tell, it worked essentially flawlessly throughout the flight. As you know, this was a long flight to fly unmanned. We had to retain a lot of accuracy in our systems. We also had to go through several fairly complex maneuvers, both with the launch vehicle and the spacecraft. All of those maneuvers were performed very successfully, and I guess today I'm very happy with the electronic pilot we had.
Go ahead.
Dick Lewis, Chicago Sun-Times. Also to Glenn Lunny, perhaps you expressed yourself on this earlier and I didn't catch it, but would you have preferred, and would you have felt easier if there had been a crew in the cockpit today?
Well, I have to qualify that answer because, as you know, this was the first time we were flying the Saturn V launch vehicle, and our attitude has been that we would want to fly at least two of those vehicles in order to assure ourselves that the launch vehicle has been properly man-rated. So in that regard, first time out, we're going to fly them unmanned. But when we move on, we'll be very glad to see the pilots back in the loop.
Good.
Julie Devine, Metalworking News. Mr. Lunny, what was the highest heat experienced by the heat shield? And can you comment on any performance parameters about the heat shield?
The best, I don't have the numbers in front of me. The best I have is that the conditions that we arrived at today were a little bit higher than we had planned for by just a few percentage points in both the total heat and the total heating rate. However, this may not end up being true when we actually get the spacecraft back, establish what the lift-to-drag ratio of the configuration was, and see what the reentry trajectory was that we actually flew. So preliminary indications are that we flew it a little bit hotter than we had planned by perhaps a percentage point, but I think all the numbers are not in on that.
Put a number on that. Our nominal mission would have given us a heating rate of 594 BTU per square foot per second. As Lonnie pointed out, based on trajectory data, we may have hit a little higher than that, which would have been a more severe test of the heat shield, but we won't know this until we analyze the data. On a nominal return from the moon, our heating rate will be about two-thirds of that number. So it has been a severe test of the heat shield.
I'd just like to apologize. I have to leave. I have to go out to the West Coast to start the next spacecraft a little bit further on its journey here. Apollo.
Okay. We're excusing Dr. Miller. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jack.
It's a long back up there.
Ed DeLong, United Press. Chris, do you have any figures yet on the heats encountered inside the command module?
No, we
We actually have no telemetry data that we've had a chance to look at that would indicate what the temperature inside the command module was.
Did you have any problems with telemetry or communications? There was some indication there might have been a telemetry problem earlier today.
We had what we think were telemetry problems a couple of times. However, as you may know, we were flying two new systems. On the launch vehicle in orbit, we were flying the S-band system, which we will use for the lunar vehicle. We were also flying the S-band frequency system, which we have on the spacecraft, the unified S-band system, which carries all of the spacecraft data. We occasionally had what we assumed to be at this time antenna pattern problems, which just mean that the attitude of the vehicle was such that the antennas on the vehicle and the ground antennas weren't properly aligned. We kind of expected that we would have some of those kind of problems during the course of the day, and I think when we get a chance to look at all the data, we'll have a better handle on what to expect next time and what we can do to improve what happened here today.
Right now, the other center directors have joined the conference at the Cape, and we want to switch down there for a statement from Dr. Von Braun.
See is that I'm highly gratified about the results of this test. It was really a textbook launching all the way through, from launching exactly on time to performance of every single stage, particularly the restart in orbit, which was something experimental, went off quite successfully. As Dr. Siemens pointed out yesterday, we wouldn't consider this launch a complete success unless we had the spacecraft safely recovered on the deck of the carrier. Now looks like this is just only a few minutes away.
Happy and somewhat tired, but I think we have achieved three main goals the last years and months and days and hours. One is a new concept of a facility has been brought in, has been constructed and exercised and proved to operate well. Past or post-launch inspection indicates that we have only minor refurbishment to do. We're very satisfied with that. Second, we had a very almost monumental task in getting together a group of people. Some are quite new in this business. We had to build up a team that would work together as if it was composed of people who had done it many, many times. To this, our countdown demonstration work has helped us immensely. In this context, I believe I can say that it's one of the most complicated, interlaced, complex launch countdowns that are in existence. And the third one, of course, is the exercising of the hardware proper that is contributory to the launch vehicle and spacecraft, and I believe this also has worked well. So I'm very happy and proud to be permitted to be part of this team, and I think that demonstration has been made that not only has been brought online a new launch vehicle of tremendous power, but also a capability that will help this nation to maintain its position in space.
Well, I'm too very proud and happy on this day. I think the entire group of people that have worked this all these systems have reason to be proud and happy too. I think both the spacecraft and the launch vehicle performed very well indeed. I believe it's perhaps easier for many of us to understand the launch vehicle performance. We can watch it, at least a good part of it. It's tremendous, and I certainly was as impressed as any. I think in some ways the spacecraft probed just as deeply into the unknown today as the launch vehicle did into the technology of large rockets. First, of course, this is the first time that a full-scale vehicle has really re-entered the Earth's atmosphere at this speed. And of course, we won't know till we see the data and have a look at the ablation material how well it did. But it was at least well enough to come back intact. We know that. There are other things that will be of interest. We had radiation monitoring aboard this craft as it went on up through to the apogee of over 10,000 miles. It will show what the radiation levels are inside the cabin. At least we hope they will if all of the instruments work. There was also on board a camera which will show an astronaut's view of the Earth from a color camera, which we hope worked. And I think that the other things that aren't so obvious right now, but which will be very, very important to us, things like the knowledge of the loads imposed on the vehicles, the vibration levels, all these things we can now put in the realm of measurement much more completely than it's much more satisfactory than having in the realm of estimates and calculation. All in all, I think that it's been a very good step forward, and I'm very happy and proud, as Kurt is and Werner is and all the rest of us, to be a part of this team.
In addition, here at the Cape, to the three Senate directors, we have General Samuel Phillips, who is Apollo Program Manager, Mr. George Lowe, who is Apollo Program Manager for the Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston, Rocco Patrone, who is Launch Director for the Apollo 4 mission from the Kennedy Space Center, and Dr. Arthur Rudolph, who is Saturn V Program Manager from the Marshall Space Flight Center. We understand that Dr. Siemens has some additional remarks at this time.
I'd just like to amplify the response I gave to the question here regarding morale. The morale of those involved in the Apollo program following the accident that we had last January was low, in the sense that everyone involved felt that there must have been something that he or she could have done to have avoided the accident. We have to recognize when we have accidents that they are not acts of God, they are human mistakes. And in that particular case, after a very careful review, we uncovered a large number of areas where we felt that we should and could make improvement. In the sense that people were dedicated to move ahead and do a better job, morale has always been high. And the group of people involved have moved ahead, I think, in a remarkable fashion following that accident. At times it has not been easy because of outside pressures and outside concerns about the capability of the team. I'm sure the team itself has wondered whether they really were up to the job and up to the responsibility. I believe that the results achieved today clearly demonstrate that this team of people, made up of NASA people and DOD, other government people, many industrial people, and university research people, truly have the competence
to not only take on the manned lunar landing program, but any other space objective that this country feels is important and to which we should dedicate our efforts.
Thank you, Dr. Siemens. I know there are a great many newsmen at the Cape, something on the order of 300, so let's go back down there and pick up their questions.
Right here in the third row.
Vic McElhenney, Boston Globe. Can I ask about the guidance system and how accurately it performed on splashdown?
The best number we have for the splashdown accuracy is 18,000 yards from the bridge of the Bennington. I expect that number will be improved somewhat as we look further at the data, but that's a pretty good estimate of what it is.
Right here in the second row. Dr. Divas, was there any measurement on the noise level, decibels at launch?
Yes, we had equipped the total launch pad with quite extensive measurements on vibration level, noise level, seismic problems, etc. We have not, temperatures of course, we have not evaluated those as yet. Walker, do you know of any measurements that we made in real time, perhaps?
No, I do not. There'll be values available shortly. Today is not available yet.
Right up here.
Peter Fairley, London Evening Standard. Can somebody tell me how the apparent disintegration of parts of the booster rocket bodes for the future of recoverable booster sections?
We have studied recoverable booster systems for a long time, and if we had a contract, we would know how to build one today. The problem is that the development of a recoverable booster system is a major investment, and you have to amortize this investment against a sizable number of launches before you ever have a chance of getting your money back. As long as we are talking only about 15 Saturn V's, we are on the wrong side of the power curve. We will never be able to get our money back. If you wanted to order 500 of them, we'd know how to do it.
Harry?
Harry Pease, Milwaukee Journal. I'd like to rephrase a question that was asked earlier and ask if any of you gentlemen, either here or in Houston, know of anything that happened today that would have endangered a crew on board. We understand that it's unthinkable on the first flight of a vehicle, but did anything occur which would have endangered a crew?
Speaking for the spacecraft, I certainly don't know of anything today that would have endangered the crew. But I think we have to stand behind the answer that Lynn Lundy gave earlier, namely that we want to fly this flight and another one before we would consider putting a man on the new launch vehicle.
I would like to add something to this answer. There's some indication, but let me emphasize that this would not have endangered the crew. But we have an indication that there was one irregularity, in all likelihood, in the so-called propulsive venting system of the S4B stage, which is the Saturn V's third stage. In order to keep the liquid hydrogen oriented on the backside of the tank, we vent the hydrogen out in such a way that it exerts a few pounds of thrust as it squirts out of the vent valve to keep a very, very slight acceleration on the vehicle, just to keep the liquid hydrogen settled at the bottom. If you didn't do this, you could lose substantial amounts of liquid hydrogen through the vent valve and go into your second burn with a half empty tank. For this reason, we have this propulsive vent feature. We have an indication that the vent valve admitting hydrogen to this propulsive vent did not close when we started to repressurize
the S4B stage for the second burn. However, there is enough gas available to override this relatively small amount of leakage that goes out through the vent. This, however, required an intelligent decision on the part of the man controlling this operation on the ground. They knew that the valve hadn't closed, and had he started to pressurize the tank, say, 5 minutes or 10 minutes before starting up the engine, he would have lost so much pressurizing helium through this open valve that he could never have built up enough tank pressure. So he waited prudently until about a minute before the restart was due, and then pressurized at a pretty rapid rate, and this brought the engine close enough into the start box for the G2 engine to restart up. And the moment the engine starts running, it produces enough evaporated hydrogen to build the tank pressure up even to the normal level. It looks like this was a kind of a marginal situation. There would have been a chance that had it not worked out so well and had it not been done so intelligently, that we may not have been able to restart the J2 engine after two orbits. What I said here requires re-verification as we look at the data, but this is the best information available at this moment.
Right here.
Dr. von Braun, this question was asked earlier this morning, but I would like to know your explanation of what we're going to do on 502 besides flying the complete unified patch. In short, what are you doing? Are you just going to retest everything just as you've done today? What is the real purpose besides the hatch for the next flight? And when would you predict it? And also, we would all like to hear your real comment at the moment of liftoff. Just what did you say?
My feeling at liftoff was, go, baby, go. All I can tell you, this is a very, very long vehicle, and it takes 10 seconds to clear the tower. These were by far the longest 10 seconds I've ever lived through. I watched it through binoculars. As far as the purpose of Launch 502 is concerned, I thought we ought to distinguish between the necessity of repeating a launch vehicle test and certain changes in the flight profile for the spacecraft as it re-enters. As far as the launch vehicle is concerned, I think you can put it down in very simple terms. Two successes in a row make you a lot more confident than one. And you have to draw a line somewhere how many flights you would like to have under the belt before you put a man on these things. And we decided that two or maybe three may be a good number. Now, as far as the spacecraft is concerned, I would suggest I pass the question on to Mr. Lowe.
Well, spacecraft 20 for the next flight, which incidentally was formally accepted at North American yesterday, is essentially identical to spacecraft 17, which was on this flight. The only difference is that whereas the new outward opening hatch was only mocked up on spacecraft 17, the actual hatch will fly on 20. I think I should say, though, that we may have gotten enough data on the hatch just from the mocked up hatch to qualify that system for manned flight at lunar entry speeds as well without the spacecraft 20 flight. But the only difference in the spacecraft is the hatch.
Right back in the second row.
What was the re-entry velocity?
The best I can tell you at this time, it was just a little bit greater than the 36,333 feet per second that we had planned for. Perhaps another 100 or 200 feet per second is all I can estimate here.
Back up here? Way back up, Chuck.
Dave Zinman from Newsday. Can you tell me when the next Apollo flight will go and what the major event will be?
The next Apollo flight will be Apollo 5. That's the LEM-1 unmanned on the launch vehicle 204. The launch vehicle's on the pad. The lunar module is in the spacecraft checkout building. The schedule will call for the LEM to be installed on the launch vehicle the latter part of this month. We expect to fly it shortly after the first of the year.
Back up here.
Dick Hoagland, Springfield Museum of Science and Springfield Union. Perhaps this has been asked before, but what is the major thing to which you attribute the spectacular success of the intensely complex mission? And how would you compare the testing of this system with the testing of, let's say, the Atlas 6 or 7 years ago? And how far we've come down the road and what this means for manned flight per se.
I guess I'm the only one here except for George Lowe that was involved in the Mercury Atlas, if you're talking about the Mercury Atlas. And it is true that this system here today is, if you measure it in terms of energy, is 20 or 30 times greater energy than was involved in the Mercury Atlas. And I think the work and the complexity and so on tends to go in the same ratio as the energy. So it was, I think, a tremendous achievement of organizing something as complex as this. You can remember, we could just about barely get a Mercury Atlas off because it was so complex in its day. And one of the first things that I thought of when we were given the task of a manned lunar landing was, gee, we're going to have to get a whole lot better technology in order to be able to handle systems that are the order 20 to 30 times as complex. And I think the performance here today shows that it is possible to do it. Although it isn't easy, and I think that we'll benefit by a lot more practice in missions of this type. And maybe Sam would like to, General Phillips would like to add something to this, but it has been a big problem, and it will, and things this complex will continue to be a problem to get off.
I don't think I could really add anything to it. I think the demonstration of Apollo 4 today was a tremendous technological achievement and represents the pulling together of a vast range of technologies and a wide range of industry. I think it was a tremendous technological achievement. And it's hard to put a number on it, but I should say it was many times greater in its accomplishments than missions of 6 or 7 years ago.
Let me add an interesting number that I'm trying to figure out here, and I hope it's correct. I think we put 285,000 pounds in orbit today. And the Atlas that lifted John Glenn into orbit, the launch vehicle, all of its propellants, and the spacecraft, fully loaded before liftoff, weighed about the same amount. So in effect, what we did today could have put the launch vehicle and the spacecraft and the propellant into orbit that we, a few short years ago, had on the pad to just launch a spacecraft.
I would like to add something to responses to your question, how come that these very complex missions are tackled with apparently a much higher degree of confidence and surely with a higher degree of success in Atlas. I think it has a great deal to do with the method, with the methods that we are using. I personally contribute, as far as the launch vehicle is concerned, the greatest reason in this field to our automatic checkout procedures. We computer check all critical elements of our launch vehicle all the way up to liftoff. This provides us with an unheard-of degree of knowledge of the state of the various subsystems, whether things, for example, like the control loop in the first or the second stage are really operating well before takeoff. So we have a much greater assurance that we won't launch a rocket with anything sick in the system before it even takes off. Now, this degree of visibility we never had in the past, but one should realize that one pays a price for this. In the first place, of course, you're dealing with computers which in themselves can introduce errors and delays. And secondly, the more you know about your vehicle, the greater is the likelihood that you do discover something that is not operative, and as a result, you cannot launch. So it is like a man seeing his doctor every 2 weeks. Chances are that the doctor, by continuously running checks on him, will update his evaluation, the evaluation of his diagnosis, a lot better than a man very rarely sees his doctor. So we have much more assurance that we won't launch a sick bird. But at the same time, the probability of hitting a red line while we are in the count is vastly increased. And for this reason, I think the fact that we were able to launch this thing on time is probably the greatest accomplishment of them all, because it shows that in spite of all that knowledge we had about the bird, we had no red line values.
Thank you, Joe.
General Phillips and his crystal ball department, at which he excels. If 502 Sam is another picture book mission or storybook mission, as much as this one seemed to be, and the first unmanned lunar module test come along well, would we advance the lunar landing program by flying the first manned Apollo flight atop a Saturn V, and would you so consider doing?
You're persistent. your ifs. I won't restate. I have every reason to believe that Apollo 4 will be another storybook mission and that Apollo 5 will also. We've organized our schedule in such a way that we're prepared to fly additional unmanned flights, specifically an additional unmanned LEM and an additional unmanned Saturn V. We have also organized our plans and our preparations in such a way that we can capitalize on real success and be able to move the program forward to the limit of the what we will judge to be reasonable in moving it forward on the basis of all the events in hand. We are organized to move forward more rapidly in the event the total situation warrants.
We understand we have some up-to-date information on the recovery efforts with the Apollo spacecraft. We're going to switch back to Houston at this time.
Yeah, Jack, the seas out there, those 8-foot swells, are making recovery one of the most difficult parts of the mission. The carrier tried once and is having to go around again and slip up on it on the good side. But the seas are rough, and we do not have an estimate right now, but they are working the problem. I know the people at the Cape are at least 8 hours more tired than we are here in Houston, so we're going to adjourn at this point. Thank you very much.